So welcome to this podcast with Herb Stevenson. Herb is a member of our organizational faculty at the Institute. He's been on faculty for a number of years. I've had the pleasure of working with him very closely on the Becoming an Effective Organizational Intervener program for three runnings. And he's a great guy, and he's a great thinker. And what I wanted Herb to talk about today was his thinking on resistance. And you're going to find out very quickly that he's expanding the definition. And so my his thinking about resistance, he's going to correct me on that. But let me give you just a little bit of background. The whole notion of resistance, as we think of it, comes out of Freud's work, and he was talking about resistance to analysis, resistance to that therapeutic relationship. And he identified a few different types of resistances and talked about repression and all that. But basically, he saw it as a bad thing, therefore a thing to be overcome. And in fact, even if you do a literature search on resistance to change in organization, the most common verb used is overcome. How do we overcome resistance? And that's pretty much in the mindset of people in organizations. And Fritz Perls came along, who had been a student of Freud's work, and said, you know, something doesn't work about this. And there was a lot that he really shifted in that whole kind of therapeutic relationship. But one was that people resist for good reasons, that they aren't opening up for, you know, any number of reasons, and we'll do better if we get curious about them and their resistance without trying to judge them or make them do something. So here's where the paradoxical theory comes in and all of that. And that's really important stuff. And just knowing that, knowing Perls' thinking on that, has been an extremely helpful thing in my own practice and for lots of people. Well, I guess 15, 20 years ago, Gordon Wheeler, who's also on our faculty, also heads Esalen, wrote a book, and he said, we don't go far enough with resistance. And he talked about resistance being a contact style. And Herb's going to talk just a little bit about Gordon's work. And then Herb, more recently, has said, okay, but there's more to it than that. And one of the things I love about that is it gets me thinking. But the other thing I love about it is Gestalt is not a dead theory, that we can have people like Herb coming along, not that there is anybody like Herb coming along, but we can have people coming along saying, you know, I see it this way, and then expand the reach and expand our thinking. So, Herb, welcome.
Thank you.
So would you just say a few words about kind of Gordon's rethinking of resistance?
Sure. What was very attractive to me is wading through, and I say that because most people, if you've read Gordon, it's not an easy read, but was the realization that one of the core pieces of Gestalt is how do we make contact with ourselves, with the world. And when we take the Gestalt approach to saying resistances are natural, I'll elaborate a little bit about what that means. My viewpoint when I'm talking to my clients is that through a series of creative adjustments, we become the person we are. So those creative adjustments are various behavioral adjustments that we might make. Somebody yells at us, so we learn to be quiet. For another person, somebody yells at you, you yell back. But it becomes a contact style. In other words, how I meet the world or how I meet myself. One of the things that helped with what Gordon wrote was by switching it to a contact style, instead of being, as often was looked at, as a pathology, it became to realize that resistance is actually a creative adjustment. Therefore, it is the way the person contacts or meets life. And what I was fascinated when I was listening to it is it started to make sense because we all, for example, if we use one of the common things in Gestalt, we use the phrase interjection, which just means that we swallow whole. So when we're in school, we swallow whole whatever the teacher tells us so we can regurgitate the facts. Later, when we get older, we learn that we need to take some of those things that we swallowed as children and digest them, which is also part of the Gestalt metaphorical correlation. And in that digestion, we begin to say, is that true or is that not true for me? For example, oftentimes we talk about good girls do, and everybody has an answer. So later what we were able to do is transact or change that process. So when I bring that back to a contact style, we learn to respond to life probably on a continuum basis as we get older. Continuum meaning that what served us as a child, which is look both ways before crossing the street, is probably something that should last your whole life. Your definition of what good girls and do or don't probably should change the same as it should for boys. So when we look at that, then contact style says enables us to say is what is that person looking at, or how are they orienting to the world? And then from the point of view of the paradoxical theory of change, and what am I not looking at, or what am I not orienting to? And now we begin to go back to one of the core pieces that Fritz talked about, which is polarities. And the polarity or paradoxical theory of change, if you go all the way back to Friedlander, is we cannot make meaning in and of itself. We have to have a polarity to lean against. So we learn what's good versus bad, because if there was no labeling, there's no meaning making. It's just behavior. The same with black versus white. We don't know color differentiation if we don't have something to make meaning of it. And so when I was playing with that, I started looking at contact styles from a point of view of what if we expand this out to a polarity and the paradoxical theory of change, and as a contact style. And I'll stop there and see if I'll take a breath and see what you have to say.
Well, no, I think that's, first of all, I think that's a wonderfully clear explanation of part of the contribution that Gordon Wheeler has made. And I just want the people listening to this to appreciate the clarity with which you just heard that. And I would recommend to people who really want to know Gestalt theory to read Gordon's book.
Mm-hmm.
However, I also agree with Herb. It's a tough slog.
Mm-hmm.
I've read it, I don't know, a few times now, and each time it doesn't get any faster for me. I may be slow, but I think it's worth going through and deciphering. And what you've done just in those few minutes is really say is I think give an avenue into his thinking that's really clear. So.
Mm-hmm.
So I know, I think we're ready to move into kind of so now where you're taking it.
Well, by combining the various issues, the context style, with the idea that we have to have polarities to make meaning, the creative adjustments, what it led me to is going back to Friedlander's original theory, which one of the crazy things about me is if you quote somebody, I'll probably go back and try to find it. Fritz cited Friedlander as helping him understand polarities and actually the meaning-making process, which is basically, the evolution of the paradoxical theory changes, as you're aware of the article I wrote in the Gestalt Review. But the way that it basically says is if everything is a polarity, the impact of it is from a contact style is when I'm working with a client, for example, and I'm seeing them looking at one side or behaving a specific way, I use the polarity of through phrases like, well, how's that serving you, and how's it not serving you? And once they start looking at the two sides of that, and then I can ask the question, well, what if we were to do something different? What would that look like? We start creating choices. And choices create conscious awareness, which, as you know, Rick, is a critical piece of Gestalt psychology as well as Gestalt, the way we practice it. So in my work with the clients, is I'm constantly carrying what Edwin Nevis said, is that we always bring to the table what doesn't exist in the system. A true Gestaltist would do that. And I always was struck by that, but what the hell does that mean? And then I began to realize if they're looking at one way, I provide the information to look at it another way. If there's confluence, meaning everybody's just agreeing, nodding their heads, and there's really no differentiation in the room, I oftentimes, as if I'm working with a team or if I'm working with a CEO, I'll be the differentiator, pushing back in a way that gets them to look at an opposing point of view. And the impact of that was is it took something out of the equation that I think is critical, and that is contact styles do not have a valence to them.
And define what the word valence means.
Valence means a value. So when I say a valence, there's not a good or bad valence to it, right or wrong valence. There's no moral implications to it. I mean, there could be. But from a coach's point of view, which is one of the things that Fritz adamantly advocated and then I bought into, is that I have to take a witnessing position. I may add, but I have to disclose any moral values that I add to it. But generally allows me to just be descriptive. Now, one of the exercises you're doing in your program, the Influence, Action, and Change, is about learning how to be descriptive, which is clearly gestalt in our long history of phenomenology. But what I found out about it, even more importantly, is by going to context styles and polarities, it allows me to say, that's where they are. What would it look like if we went over here? And I don't get into bad behavioral judgments against them. I might describe it as if that were to happen to you, how would you describe it? And they may say, well, that's pretty bad behavior. Well, it's still descriptive in the sense that they could look at it. One of the fastest things that I've learned over the years is if you want to shut your client down, judge them. You know, I mean, that just, it's, you and I know that in all of our years. So, as I've gone through this, continue to work with the contact styles as a continuum, is the way I now phrase it. It helps me because if I look at it as only a polarity, I'm bouncing off of each other. Because what I finally came to the realization, and this comes off the work that I wrote about on Friedlander, is if you know the mathematical term interpolation, you may not be able to get exactly to an answer, but you can get close enough that it works. So if you're trying to find an answer to something and you start at 4 and you're at 1 and then you keep going back and forth, getting closer and closer to this midpoint, you finally have success. Well, picture it this way. If I expand the capacity of choices to play in between the two polarities, that gives more behavioral choices for that person to engage the world. If I provide it as a continuum of one or the other, it also allows them to examine who do I want to be and how do I want to be. And the impact of that is it's interesting because people tend to prefer better behavior if they have conscious awareness. They tend to choose to for greater clarity, less judgment. And the result of it is I want them to slide up and down the continuum because I think both sides of what we call contact styles or we used to call resistances are critical to the effectiveness of any executive.
Okay. So let's take, you mentioned introjection being one of the classic ones where we swallow things whole. So imagine you're in a work setting and you have a client who's introjecting. So I'm assuming that man or woman has got a whole bunch of rules about how you run things and what you do that they really haven't chewed on themselves. They've just somehow, they've just swallowed whole. This is the way things are done.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing what you know about this continuum, then what would be your thinking process and what might you do?
Well, I'll give you an example. It's common for, and it's not saying this is majority, but at the CEO level or let's just say the executive level, it could be the C-suite, vice presidents or above. A lot of these people are highly competent individuals. And if I'm brought in for a situation where what we have is a person who's highly directive, micromanaging, getting into details is the way that would be. They probably somewhere along the line heard something from their parents as an interject that's now become a truth, such as never depend on others. or if you want to do it right, do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as you and I know, because of what we do, is if the senior executive does that, they'll either burn out or run off all of their people and probably will get fired. And so when I have somebody who is very rule-bound, it's usually the introductions. And so what I try to do is soften it and says, well, I understand about never depend on others, but is that true all the time? I mean, is everybody literally that bad? Well, no. Well, how bad are they? And unraveling that story until they realize, well, you know, that's my dad taught me this a long time ago, or my first boss taught me this, or I was depending on somebody in my first job and I got burned and I swore I'd never do it again. And so as we unravel that, and I say, well, what are some ways that maybe you do depend on others? And they begin to realize they actually have the capacity to do both, but under stress, they will go back to the original interject, which is never depend on others.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I use the phrase pause, reflect, and choose, which is if you have a big energy around something, be upset, nervous, something, get them track their bodies, stop for a second and ask yourself, is this really true? And people have been around me as I like to use, I guess I channel Fritz sometimes because I like to use graphic descriptions. And so when they get into that, I'll try to exaggerate a situation. So never depend on others. I ask them maybe to say, well, I want you to visually look around for anybody who's loafing, not doing anything, and isn't trying to be part of the team. And I want you to identify them. And they look back at me and say, well, that's not true. And I says, well, wait a minute. You can never depend on others. What others? And by exaggerating, one of the things about paradoxical theory is if you exaggerate, the person gets a clearer picture and lets go of it. It allows them to begin to realize is, oh, sometimes, depending on others, it's not wise. And if that's true, does that mean you need to go do it, or does that mean you just need to provide a little more either guidance, direction, or supervision? And suddenly, the depth of their meaning-making goes up,
yeah,
and they're able to move forward.
So let me just throw something in here. We're in phase three of the program right now, and everybody's out working on whatever project they're working on in their organization. And we're asking them when they work with their coaches to do two things. One is really work on your observational skills, and then the second is develop some experiments. And so as you were talking about kind of that scale from interjection to what word would you use for the other end of that scale with interjection?
Say it again so I can grasp it.
I'm sorry. You talked about interjection, and that would be at one end.
Oh, okay.
The contact style. What you? I know you have words, and I don't have the article in front of me.
Yep.
What's the word do you recall that you used to describe the other end of that continuum?
Rejection.
Rejection. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's a good point. So the idea, if you swallow everything, or you swallowed something that you've not differentiated, digested, as we would phrase. The opposite side of that is, and let me give you a phrase that most people, or at least you and I would understand because of our age, is a person who tends to interject is often referred to as gullible or naive. The old kid phrase was they're guppy. They'll swallow anything. Okay?
Okay.
Well, I figured you'd know that one.
Yeah, sure.
So that's our age. But rejection is the interesting. Rejection is then is the polar opposite, and we all do various parts of this. But rejection is they don't allow anything in, and they question everything. They give you a hard time. It's just that that's not true, or it's not true for me. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if you actually even try to negotiate. Their capacity to take in information directly oftentimes is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the person who is constantly bashing into other people or various things because they're so highly differentiated, they haven't clarified themselves of when is it safe to take in something else that somebody says is true. And they could have a flip side of that of never depend on others, which is never depend on others to tell the truth.
Yeah. So let me go back to then this assignment that people are working on right diligently right now, as you and I are talking.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me, if we're talking about that continuum of introjection to rejection, the first thing we ought to do, the pause, reflect part of your model, is just with curiosity and openness, take a look at what am I doing right now?
Mm-hmm.
The choices that I'm making right now, and like what's, you know, as I look around the room, does it mean I can't trust anybody?
Right.
Or, you know, that sort of, so the first step is then the observation, just, you know, having a really good set of lenses to look at the situation. And then the second thing, it sounds like you're suggesting, is now let's try some experiments. You don't necessarily have to give up what you're doing, but are there places where I might delegate a little bit more, where I might loosen the reins, or I might test my assumptions?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example, because when we, it's staying where we were. So we have interjection on one side, where you can't trust anybody, but another way of rejection might be, which is interesting, is an interject that is a buried interject, which is the world's not safe. And so the world's not safe if I swallow anything you tell me is the interesting part. But the rejection is if I reject everything. And if I'm talking to somebody, I say, well, you know, if you're not taking anything in, you know, what is this? Are they going to poison you? Well, no, they're not going to poison you. And I said, what do you think it's going to do? And they look at me and they have a hard time for it. And I said, well, when I don't feel safe, here's a trick that I do. And they look at me and think I'm crazy, but the truth matters. What I do is I pause, look around, and see if anybody's pointing a gun at me. And if there's no guns in the room, I'm probably not going to die shortly.
That's great.
And they look at me, you know, and you know me well enough. I'm crazy enough. I do this with CEOs. And they said, well, that's not what I mean. I said, it is exactly what you mean, because if you're not feeling safe and you can't take anything in, we've got to find a way to soften you to be at least somewhat permeable for other information or input or whatever it is. And I go through, if I have to, I even go further than that. So if, you know, if they're really exaggerating, I'll say, well, I don't see any dead bodies. Nobody's pointing guns at us. Do you see any? And they it's somewhat facetious, but I've engaged them in the unraveling of a fixed context style.
Got it. Very nice. Really,
and
like
it just allows me then to give them choices. And if I were to bring this to a head of one process that this has led to and why I use it, is the context dials allows me to understand my job is to increase the number of choices in action and perceptions of the client.
Mm-hmm.
If I increase the number of choices they can perceive, there's a greater chance we can increase actions. If I can get them to do, as you said, small experiments, or as we say in the Institute, safe emergencies, something that feels a little dangerous but is beyond the normal behavior, I'm making great progress.
That's great. That's great. And I think this might be a good place to end this conversation. I think this is a good place to end this, because you've written a paper which I think is really quite good, that's in the materials that everybody has. And it talks about exactly what you're talking about here, but it also puts it into a very strong context for where this comes from and where it is, and then list a number of the other polarities. And so I would really urge people, if you got intrigued by this conversation today and what Herb's saying, that, you know, to go to that article.
Great.
So thank you, sir.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's always good to chat with you.